So tonight, I'm basing this entire talk on one particular sutta called the Kaka Kupama Sutta. It's translated roughly as the simile of the saw, which is an interesting name for it because actually this whole sutta is actually a collection of stories and similes and metaphors and images used to illustrate the meanings of right action and right speech, particularly in relationship to other people. This is an area where we're often quite reactive when we're dealing with other people, and we will respond automatically or righteously or out of habit patterns. And so a lot of this is about, he gives lots of examples, the Buddha gives lots of examples in this sutta about situations, and then he of course explains what should have happened in these situations. So the first of these is about a monk named Paguna, and I just want to read a little bit of the sutta to start.
Anyhow, I'll just finish. What this monk, he was associating with the bhikkhunis, that if a bhikkhuni, it's just a bhikkhuni's a nun, right? If a bhikkhu spoke this praise of these bhikkhunis in his presence, he would become angry and displeased and would make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu spoke this praise of him in those many's presence, they would become angry and displeased and would make a case of it. So basically, this monk is hanging out the nuns too much and being protective of them. And they then, in return, protect them. The nuns are protective of him. So here's now I'll continue with what the Buddha had to say. Paguna, is it true that you're associating overmuch with bhikkhunis? That you're associating so much with the bhikkhunis instead of a bhikkhu? Speaks this praise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu speaks this praise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Are you associating so much with bhikkhunis, as it seems? Yes, venerable sir. And the Buddha replies, Paguna, you are not a clansman. Are you not a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness? So aren't you a monk? Right? Paguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman gone forth out of faith with the home into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks the praise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein you should train thus. My mind will be unaffected. I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. This is how you should train Paguna. And it goes on basically in this. And he also says that the same thing about the bhikkhunis shouldn't react this way either. So the Buddha is trying to make two points here actually. The first is that, and this is based on the monastic tradition at the time, you know, because he had gone forth, because he had taken vows as a monk, he should no longer act as if he were a householder, which is, I mean, if he was a householder protecting the women in his household, this would be a perfectly normal thing to do. But as a monk, having someone who's gone forth, this is improper behavior. He's getting distracted, essentially, and not acting in a way that a monk should act. And he's also causing trouble because then people are complaining about him. And then, you know, so it's like it's stirring up the Sangha and he's stirring up the bhikkhunis who are then protecting him because they like to be protected because, you know, that's part of what, you know, their issues. They have the same issues. They get angry if someone attacks him. And they shouldn't be doing that either, because they're bhikkhunis, they're forth, right? It's the same kind of issue there. So that's one thing he's trying to say. But on another level, he should also understand that he's acting out of anger. He gets angry and then he reacts. You know, the anger arises and then he's caught in this reactive pattern of anger. And that is the bigger issue in a sense. It's that he's not learning to see anger arise and go, oh, anger has arisen, and that's okay, and not fall into his habitual reactive patterns that he had as a householder. And this is just the way this is part of the training. The training is to not go, and this seems kind of weird to us, because like, well, you know, you're supposed to protect each other and that sort of thing. But this is within this tradition of monasticism. This was like very improper. And it's also, as I said, it's like he's also not only breaking the training in that sense of hanging out with the bhikkhunis too much, you know, as tempting as that might be, but he's also not learning to see and identify with his anger and not be reactive, which is part of the training as well. And this is difficult. this isn't an easy thing, either for a bhikkhu, for a monk, or for us as householders, not to get caught in these reactive patterns. And often those patterns arise because we have such a strong identification with our sense of self. If someone, you know, this is me, note the me there, you know, we have such a strong identification with our own self that's what makes us angry, because our self has been dissed, right? But that's because we're caught in identification with the separate self. And that's another layer of the teaching here. Oh, here's this. We get angry because we get caught in this identification with our separate, of me being separate, that I'm the one who's being attacked. There's a famous saying, and I'm still looking for the actual source of this, but I've seen it repeated many times. It's like all anger. Arises from thwarted lust and wounded pride. I'll repeat that. All anger arises from thwarted lust or wounded pride. Now, lust here means much more than just physical lust for, you know, some sort of physical contact with another human being. It means, you know, overwhelming desire. I have a desire for something and I don't get it. And this is where anger arises. Or someone is saying something about me that I don't like. Wounded pride. That's where all our anger comes from those two places. Thwarted and wounded pride. So these are reactive states that arise because we have such a strong identification with self. Like somehow I deserve to get that stuff I want. I deserve to be, people treat me with respect. I, all the time here. And this is how we get caught in these patterns. I want to read something from one of Joseph Goldstein's book. This is from his book, Insight Meditation, where he's talking about this issue. Our great talent, challenge, and potential is to learn how to stay open to the whole range of feeling without adding an extra sense of I, mine, in the midst of it. And one practical device often helps us is to see three things going on in the midst of a strong emotion. When we become angry, for example, First, there is some external situation prompting the anger to arise. Someone is doing or saying something we do not like or we feel is harmful to ourselves or others. Second, there's our reaction to that situation, namely the feeling of anger. And the third component is the relationship of our mind to the anger itself. Usually we are lost in the first two, the external situation and our reaction to it. Something happens, we get angry. As we get angry, we start thinking about what happened. All those thoughts create more anger, which in turn creates thoughts about the situation, often with blame, self-righteousness, and hurt feelings. Thus, we quickly become caught in a destructive loop. If you seek a way out of such cycles, try turning your attention away from the situation and your reaction to it, and towards the third component, the relationship of your mind to the emotion, whether it is anger, fear, or whatever. For example, in the midst of whirling wind of anger, you might ask yourself, how am I getting caught in this anger? How am I getting hooked by it? How am I identifying with it? So step back and look at the content as opposed to the story. Asking some form of that question is completely different from considering the external situation. At such a time, we are no longer sending out threads of blame that bind us to the situation, to the reaction, and to our identification with the emotion. We are no longer thinking about the external cause of the anger, so we are no longer feeding it. That's the key thing. We often in these situations feed that emotion. We also do not ask the question for the purpose of getting an answer or having an intellectual response. Rather, the question's purpose is to help us change perspective, to take responsibility for what arises in our mind. In the moment of asking, how am I getting hooked? We have already moved outside the anger and are looking at the way we are relating to it. It is possible in that moment for the whole mess of anger to dissolve without our denying it, repressing it, or shoving it away. This is really skillful practice with strong emotions. It's like looking at it and going, how did I get here? Like stepping back up far enough to be able to actually just look at it in that way. How did I get here? And that stepping back and asking the question creates the space to be able to A, see it more clearly, and B, for it often just go, because now the reaction isn't being fed anymore. We're not feeding more story into the story about the story. We're just looking at it. That it just, that's the thing that breaks the story, that dissolves, as he says, dissolves it without denying, repressing it, or shoving it away. In other words, we haven't denied that we are angry. You know, we haven't denied that anger has arisen. But we're trying to step back and go, what was it? How, what am I identifying with that is causing this anger? Am I caught in some form of, you know, thwarted lust or wounded pride? Is that what's really going on here? And this is a famous, really an interesting way to think about these powerful emotions. I used to be part of a yoga organization for a long time, and this famous teacher Swami Shivananda of Rishikesh was the sort of the image head. Though my teacher's name was Swami Vishnu Devananda, and Shivananda had this famous quote that we used to sing and chant. It was like written on the wall of places. It was like a big deal, but it's quite bare insult, bare injury. Highest yoga. Bare insult, bare injury, highest yoga. Oh, instead of getting caught in that process, see if you can step back and just not feel the need to react and defend. And what the Buddha is talking about in this particular case is what is often called righteous anger, right? It's that we think it's somehow okay to express or even act out from a place because we are right. I'm right and they're wrong. Not only am I right, but they're wrong, right? Note the I and they. It's like here we are caught in this image of separation, and then I'm on the right side of the line here. We see this all the time in our political discourse in the world. I mean, if this is what, sad to say, much of what is going on in politics these days is exactly this. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't defend those who need protection, because there are people who need protection. But we need to, not from a place of anger or blame. Somehow we have to be able to keep our balance, not be caught in the anger and blame. Like these poor people, how come they're here? All those nasty politicians have done this. And, you know, we go off in those rants. Instead, just act appropriately and help where we can. Now, this is something that can be quite skillful as a way to deal with the situation that normally would make us angry. Instead, you know, we might, in fact, and here's another layer of this, we might feel the anger initially and sort of go through this process. But once we've dissipated the anger skillfully, then it's time to act often. Not place of anger, but just from a place of understanding, this is not, this. What's happening here is inappropriate, we need to do something about it, but not with a wagging finger at those terrible people who caused this to happen, blah, 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 all those stories that we tell ourselves all the time. This is, so anger can be an impetus to act in a wholesome way, but we have to deal with the anger first, and then when that's clear, now act. It's a different mode. So the Buddha goes on here. And he's talking about how it's important, and once again talking about this bhikkhu and how he'd been acting, about seeing unwholesome mind states and doing what we can to dissipate them. So this is the next verse in the sutta. Therefore, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states. For that is how you will come to growth, increase, fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Here's another image. Suppose there were a big solid tree grove in a village or town, and it was choked with oil weeds, and some man would appear desiring its good, welfare, and protection. He would cut down and throw the crooked saplings that rob the sap, and he would clean up the interior of the grove and tend the straight and well-formed saplings, so that the solid tree grove later on would come to growth, inks, and fulfillment. So too, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourselves to wholesome states, for that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and the plan. This word abandon you see a lot in this stuff, and it's like to abandon something means you totally give up. I'm going to give up those mind states. Abandon them. It's not like, well, sort of do what you can. It's like you got to get serious here and abandon them. And at the same time, the image is also cleaning up the weeds. Well, that's how you abandon them, by cleaning up the weeds until you have nothing left but the straight, strong saplings that you've cultivated. And this is another, I think you often see, where we're actually, this practice is about cultivating wholesome mind states. Cultivating implies we have to do something. We have to, you know, to make them grow, we have to do something. We have to feed them and nurture them and nurture them and plant them in the first place sometimes. So it's an effort that has to take place. So that's the first section of the sutta. Now the second story, it's a different story. Formerly, because it is said in this Samsavati, there was a house named Vedika, and a good report about Mistress Vedika had spread thus. Mistress Vedika is gentle. Mistress Vedika is meek. Mistress Vedika is peaceful. Now, Mistress Vedika had a maid named Kali, who was a clever, nimble, and neat in her work. The maid Kali thought, a good report about my lady has spread thus. Same. How is it now? While she does not show anger, it is nevertheless all actually present in her, or is it absent? So she never shows anger, but is it there or not? Or else it is just because my work is neat and my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her. Suppose I test my lady. So this maid, Kali, decides to sort of push the edges and see what happens. And basically, she stops doing her job quite so well. She starts showing up a bit later, and she's a bit sloppy. And the mistress is just like, oh, everything's okay, everything's okay, everything's okay. And then finally, she says, so the maid Kali got up still later in the day, and Mistress Vedika said, hey, Kali, what is it, madam? What is the matter with you? You get up still later every day. Nothing is the matter. Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl. You get up still later every day. And she was angry and displeased, and she took a rolling pin, gave her a blow to the head, and cut her head. The maid Kali, with blood running from her head, denounced her mistress and neighbors. See, ladies, the gentle ladies work. See, ladies, the meek ladies work. See, ladies, the peaceful ladies work. So she provoked her until she reacted. So what's this about? I mean, it's like, and I think it's basically, here the Buddha is talking about two things. I'll read a little bit of this. So too, bhikkhu, some bhikkhus is extremely gentle. Courses of speech do not touch him, but it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch him that it can be understood whether the bhikkhu is really kind, gentle, and peaceful. I do not call a bhikkhu easy to admonish who is easy to admonish and makes himself easy to admonish only for the sake of getting robes, alms food, a resting place, and medicinal requisites. These are the four things that monks were given by the householders. They had enough to eat. So he's saying sometimes these guys just come along and they take robes only to get the requisites. Free food, a place to stay, a nice robe, you know, any medicine they might need. But, and then it goes on. Why is that? Because that bhikkhu is not easy to admonish, nor make himself easy to admonish when he gets no robes, alms food, resting place, or medicinal requisites. So it's like, because when these guys don't get there what they want, then they get all upset and angry. Because they only took the robes, they went forth to get these things, as opposed to went forth to sort of truly lead the holy life. And so this point is, it's easy to be calm, be calm and full when nothing distressing is happening. It's all that. You know, there's nothing much going on. Nothing's bothering me. So it's quite easy to be calm and peaceful then. But the real test is when things go wrong, you know, especially if what goes wrong affects you directly. You know, people often appear holy or put on the appearance of being holy just to get what they want. Or to be praised. Oh, this person's so wonderful and holy, right? But suppressed emotions always come out in the end. Somehow or other, often in very unpleasant ways, like, you know, getting hit over the head with a rolling pin. It's not something that you'd want to have happen. And so this is the second point he's trying to make about these powerful emotions is that people can have the appearance of not having those emotions. But when they get into a stressful situation, then you really understand what's really going on with them, whether they're putting on a show, or, here's an interesting thought, whether you think you're calm and holy, but then all of a sudden you realize you've been putting on a show because you're in a stressful situation and you explode. Oh, this is a way to sort of learn about yourself as well. Am I pretending to be calm and holy because things are easy right now, but I get into this stressful, difficult place, and sure enough, Mount Vesuvius arises again, just like that, you know, we have to see that in ourselves as a potential, I suppose. Then it goes on again. He says, and now he's talking about speech. And this is actually, this is quite a famous verse. Because there are these five course speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or harm, spoken with the mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue. When others address you, their speech may be gentle or harsh, etc. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we will utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with the mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with the mind imbued with kindness. So no matter, you know, if the speech is the second half of all of these pairs, timely or untimely, et cetera, et cetera, this is something that we have to consciously think about, because often where does anger arise from? It arises when someone speaks in a certain way that affects you directly in some way or another. That's when we get wound up more often than any other time, you know, because we have this elaborate sense of self that we need to protect. And when someone says something that, quote, attacks that sense of self, that's when anger arises in us. We get caught instead of being able to, as the Buddha says, you know, what we need to do is we shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with the mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, and immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train, bhikkhus. We're saying this is how we have to learn to react when people don't speak appropriately. Another thing I want to read here. This is from Joseph's book, Mindfulness. And interestingly, this is not about mindful speech directly. It's what Joseph in his book here calls mindful listening, which is a very much a part of mindful speech. Not only do we need to speak mindfully, but we need to listen mindfully. That's the flip side of the coin, so to speak. Right speech also has its implications for how we listen. The Buddha outlined a practice for staying mindful of how another person is addressing us without getting caught up in our own reactivity. And even more than that, he enjoins us to abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness. And then he just actually quotes exactly that speech I just read to you. Listening with compassion and loving kindness Even when harsh or untrue words are addressed to us, is a tremendously challenging aspect of mindfulness. Putting it mildly, I think, but and it's a good example for what it means to be mindful externally as well as internally. Although such listening may seem very difficult to accomplish, in fact, many parents demonstrate it easily with their young children. Children in moments of frustration or upset will yell at their parents, "I hate you." And yet for many parents, at least much of the time, the response remains loving. This practice could transform the world if people would begin to apply it throughout their lives. Able to just listen in a non-reactive way and not take it personally, which is often what we do. We get caught up in the personal. You know, one says, "I hate you," and oh, and you have to really like the person or respect them or something, and they say something like that, and it's like the world just came to an end, right? But no, it's like you have to learn to sort of, "Well, that's okay. This is their stuff. What's going on is they're expressing their stuff. Doesn't have anything to do with who I am, really. It's just them." That's where we have to sort of, the place we have to land with this. And also sometimes some things they say might actually be meaningful. It's something we weren't aware of that we did, for instance. So we have to listen in that sense too and take that in and go, "Oh, yeah, I guess I was being a bit of a jerk." And take that in as well. And so that's also part of this whole mindful listening thing. This list of things, you often see it listed. I mean, he was listed in the negative, but often you'll see this list reduced, especially in memes on Facebook, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't know. It's often reduced to just the wholesome list: timely, true, gentle, connected with good, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness. It's good practice before we speak to make sure that we are about to say meets all of these. This is right intention, what he's speaking about here in a sense. You know, we have this intention to not cause harm. And where we cause harm more than any place else is through speech. So can I, before I speak, because remember, before we have make any action of a body or speech, there has to be the mental formation of intention has to arise before we do those things. Can I actually look at what I'm about to say, pause long enough to go, "Is this timely, true, gentle, connected with good, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness?" And if it is, then sure, go ahead and say it. Fine. But if you don't meet those criteria, it's time to pause and go, "What's going on here? Why am I feeling so righteous while I'm speaking this way or saying this?" Because that's often where, you know, if we're not careful, that we often get caught in those sort of righteous places. So, going on. So then, this next section I think is also interesting, where basically the bhikkhu, the Buddha uses these different images to explain the inevitability of others speaking improperly and how we should react. Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and said, "I shall make this earth to be without earth." He could dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, "Be without earth, be without earth." What do you think, bhikkhus? Could that man make this great earth be without earth? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. It is not easy to make it without earth. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So, bhikkhus, these are five courses of speech. Here in Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. And starting with him, we shall abide. So this is a repetition. But what he's, the image he's saying is, it's inevitable. This person thought, oh, I can dig so much, I can dig away all the earth. That's like expecting never to hear someone speak harshly towards you. That's the point the Buddha's making. Then he goes on. Bhikkhu, suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, or carmine. These are dyes that were used, the dye cloth, and said, I should draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless and non-manifestive. It is not easy to draw and make pictures that there or make pictures appear there. Eventually that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. But here's another example of how impossible something is to draw pictures in the air with dye, because there's nothing to draw on. There's no solidity to what's being drawn on. And then this last one. Bhikkhu, suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could the man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with that blazing grass torch? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the river Ganges is deep and immense. It is not easy to heat up or burn away with a blazing torch. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So these are images of the impossibility, in a sense, of how we should train to deal with a disagreeable speech, because it's inevitable. There's no way we can avoid that at times people are going to speak to us or act towards us in disagreeable, unpleasant ways. It's just the way things are. Yeah, and that sounds, you know, a little almost depressing, I suppose. But actually, I think it's a quite an interesting thought. Here's this is something from the Dhammapada. So the Dhammapada, if you're not familiar with it, is a sort of a collection of more pithy, poetic sayings of the Buddha. And it's divided into various sections. This happens to be a section called anger. This has come down from old, Atula, and not just from today. They find fault with one who sits silent. They find fault with one who speaks a great deal. They find fault with one who measures his words. There's no one faulted in this world. But it doesn't matter. You know, you can be sit silent, they'll fault you. You can talk a great deal, they'll fault you. You can speak with measured words, they'll fault you. Someone is going to complain no matter what. It's inevitable. Huh? There never was, will be, nor at present is found, anyone entirely faulted or entirely praised. Of course, we want to be entirely praised, right? That's our nature. There never was, will be, nor at present is found, anyone entirely faulted or entirely praised. It's impossible to have a life like that. It just doesn't work that way. It's we wish it was, but it isn't. That's a good way to say it. There's also nothing on this subject. This is from Sharon. This is Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. She's talking about how to deal with these difficult situations when people are being unkind or speaking or acting in an unkind way. How can we let go in such a situation? How can we change it? We can focus our attention more on the suffering of the situation, both our own and the suffering of others, rather than on our anger. So it's okay to, you know, acknowledge the anger, but look at how you are suffering and how the other person is clearly suffering to be acting in that way. We can ask ourselves whom we are really angry at. This is a good question. We can ask ourselves whom we are really angry at. Mostly what we are angry at is the anger in the other person. It's almost as if the other person were an instrument for the anger that moves through them and motivates them to act in unskillful ways. We do not become angry at somebody's mouth when they are shouting at us. We are angry at the anger that is motivating them to shout. If we add anger to anger, we only serve to increase it. I love that image of we're not angry at their mouth. We're angry at what's coming out of it. It's two different things. And if we can sort of start to see that and start to see that what's coming out of their mouth is based on their suffering, that they're caught in suffering when they're doing this. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. Then, and we can also look clearly and see how it makes us, how we feel, what's going on in our own heart minds, and see ourselves reacting, and that how that reacting causes our own suffering. This is a skillful way to work with these situations. A skillful way to work with being confronted with anger in all of its various forms. Finally, this is remember this was called the simile of the saw. So where's the saw being in all this, right? This is the second last verse. Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Here in Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. So these guys have come along and are sawing you apart with a two-handled saw, and you're still supposed to abide with a heart full of loving kindness. Well, this is extreme, but these are bhikkhus. So this doesn't, I mean, this is for us as householders, it'd be a little less so, perhaps. We wouldn't want to let people chop us up with a saw. But what he's saying is, if that situation, if it's just you, notice there's no one else involved here. There's just the bhikkhu and these guys chopping them up. There's no other person involved. Then they would have to somehow be able to not react, even in that situation. And I remember when the first time I read this, I was like, oh, yeah, sure. That was really my, yeah, sure. Yeah, I can see that. But then I heard this great story, the story that the Dalai Lama tells. You know, the Dalai Lama escaped Tibet in 59 or so. But not all the monks who were part of his tradition and his got out when he got out. And some of them were captured and imprisoned, sometimes for very long times. And they were not treated very well. And so this sometime later, some years after the Dalai Lama's escaped, and this old monk comes into Dharamsala because he somehow or other managed to escape from Tibet. And he's been treated very poor, and it's quite clear he's banged up. And he's talking to the Dalai Lama about his experience. He's saying, well, you know, I'm I was really scared. I was really scared when I was imprisoned by these people. And the Dalai Lama says, well, of course, they look, they were beating you and, you know, treating you and starving you and treating you real badly. And the monk says, no, no, it wasn't that. I was really afraid I would get angry. This guy had spent like 10 or 15 years in prison being beaten and mistreated. And his biggest problem was he was afraid he might get angry. This is where this discipline heads. One place with this. Can we be that strong where we wouldn't get angry in that situation? I mean, it seems unbelievable, to be honest with you. And which gets me to the last thing I want to say. This is, remember, this is, well, everything I've been talking about, this is all about practice. So don't think, well, I'm not like that, I'm perfect like that, so forget it. No, we're practicing to move towards that. That's what this practice is about. Can I be less reactive in these situations? Can I learn to not so frequently react? That would be great. That would be a big step forward if I didn't so frequently react in an angry way to being disrespected and treated in this way. Can I learn to see that anger arising and let it go? And that's why they call this practice. This isn't a perfection. You know, we don't all have to be like that monk that was talking to the Dalai Lama. You know, that's headed in that direction. But if we can just be somewhat reactive, just a little bit reactive, just in one situation, catch ourselves and go, here I am in one of those situations that the talk was about. Maybe I can just not get quite so caught up. That'd be fantastic. Because that means you're practicing. That's practice in real day-to-day life. And also, you know, think this in terms of practice, sitting still, practice, so there's no other people involved. But a lot of those stories and memories we have are about things like this. And what happens when we have those memories and we start telling our stories again? We get angry again, even though this happened 20 years ago. But sure enough, because we're telling ourselves that story brings up the energy of that story, and we get caught in the cycle of anger yet again, and again, and again. And this is just, oh, wait, now I've just got caught in reaction yet again. Can I somehow, in the midst of that story, see and feel, because anger always has a strong physical component, can I feel the anger? Can I see the anger and go, oh, it's just this story. This is just something from my mind. Nothing's happened. This is 20 years ago. Nothing's happening right now. In the present moment, all that is happening is this story's running in my head. Can I let that story go and even perhaps offer some thoughts of loving kindness towards that person or that situation or those people or whatever it was that was the cause of that anger in that story? Can I shift that memory so that the next time the memory comes up, it'll be a little less caustic, a little less powerful, a little less tendency to grab me? Because I sort of step back and let it go and offer a thought of loving kindness instead. I'm not saying this is easy, but this is what the practice is all about. This is where the practice takes us, so that we less and less get caught in unwholesome mind states, and more often wholesome mind states arise instead. I'm just trying to change the balance of my mind. That's all I really want to do. I want to move towards perfection, but have no expectation at all of being perfect, which is just a dangerous place to go. Poem here, which reflects exactly what I was just saying. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, called Awakening Now. I'm sure some of you have heard me read it before, but it's one of her right on poems. Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells, prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, your eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid, and my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in the light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening.